This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There's going to be a long sorting out in communities about what fracking is going to look like. It's going to be a push and pull, and there's going to be efforts by backers of development to enter more places, and there's going to be folks in communities and elsewhere who are going to want to pull back.
Even the most casual followers of energy policy have become aware of the controversy surrounding the massive expansion of fracking in this country over the past decade. Successful attempts to lift the curtain on fracking, like Josh Fox's 2010 documentary film Gasland, have spurred a grassroots movement to push back on natural gas giants and lobbyists who would have us believe that fracking is clean and safe. So who's winning this battle for America's health and well-being, fought on the parallel fronts of policy and PR? This week on Sea Change Radio, I speak to Neela Banerjee, a journalist who covers energy and environmental policy for the Los Angeles Times, to get an update on the latest developments in natural gas exploration. She talks about the fight to keep drinking water safe around the 77,000 natural gas wells throughout the country and the controversy surrounding the use of unpermitted diesel fuel in the fracking process. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Neela Banerjee. She covers energy and environmental policy for the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times. Neela, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me again.
So I wanted to talk about some of the work that you've been doing covering fracking. Anybody who's seen Josh Fox's Gasland is familiar with the talking point that there's 600 plus chemicals in fracking solutions, and the companies keep them very close to their vest. But that was shot several years ago. Can you give us an update on what has become more transparent, or if there has been more transparency in the industry, and what you and your colleagues are learning more about fracking as this evolves?
The way I approach this is that I try to rely on peer-reviewed science about the issue, because there's so many competing and contradictory claims made by industry and environmentalists that I figure that the best way to do this is to look at what scientists are saying and what the data and what, you know, other journalists are producing from publicly available data. And so what we've learned over the last few years is that there, for example, what is in fracking fluid? Fracking fluid is what is injected along with water and sand into geological formations to crack open those formations and improve the flow of oil and gas. Well, there's a website that industry set up called Frack Focus that industry voluntarily submits information to about what's in the fracking fluid. But there are loopholes here. There's a catch here. So we know a little bit more, but the catch is that if a company thinks that certain constituents of that fluid are trade secrets, they don't include those substances in their listing. They don't tell you, and there's no criteria on Frack Focus as to how a company can decide whether it's a trade secret or not. So that's, I think that's one of the things, is that to this day people really don't know, including a lot of regulators really don't know what's going down the hole when fracking occurs. So, and there was, and there's a lot of science that comes my way that I don't even get a chance to write about. So for example, last week when these two articles came out that were based on studies, one was peer reviewed, the other was on publicly available data. There was another study that came out at, I think it was the American Chemical Society conference in San Francisco, where scientists said that they looked at what was in fracking fluid, and they found out that the industry's right that a lot of the stuff isn't harmful, but we don't know what concentrations, and there is stuff in fracking fluid that is harmful, that are known carcinogens and so on. But again, we don't know about their concentrations, and we don't know about how much actually comes back up the hole, companies try to hold on to fracking fluid because it's expensive. They try to recycle it. But there is a phenomenon called leak-off, which means that some of the fluid stays in the geological formation. And it's unclear what percentage is, what percentage of fluid stays down there. So I think the problem, years after Gasland, is that the picture is still very incomplete, because the entities that could give us the fullest picture, which is probably regulators, right, either state or federal regulators who have the authority and could go in and get this bigger view, could get detail, they just haven't been able to do that, or have not been willing to do that.
So, Neela, perhaps you can go through some of the campaigns in states that are trying to force gas companies to reveal the chemicals they inject into the ground.
Well, some states do require companies to post their, to post their information on Frac Focus, but companies can go back and change that information on Frac Focus. Again, they can claim that things are the substances are. Trade secrets. I think in Texas, for example, and I may be remembering this incorrectly, a trade publication, E&E News, did a very good story a couple of years ago in which they said that this sort of voluntary sharing of information really didn't work, because there's so many substances were declared trade secrets that an individual who might want to look and see what was there wouldn't be able to, to determine what was actually being used in fracking. So that's one thing. But the other, the other issue too is it's not just finding out what's in fracking fluid, but you need to understand the concentrations, whether it's affecting water supplies, whether both groundwater and surface water, if there's spills and so on, and what is being done to ensure that those problems aren't occurring. And by and large, states are not doing a whole lot on that, and the federal government isn't doing a whole lot of monitoring, especially before fracking begins, right? Like, you need part of the debate about water has been, researchers and sometimes regulators show that maybe water has been affected by oil and gas operations, and what I mean by that is not just fracking, which is a particular activity, but things like, for example, a well may not be properly cemented. Industry often replies by saying, well, that stuff that you're finding in the water was there to begin with. So the way you would solve those debates is if you get baseline testing of water resources in areas where fracking occurs. And that, as far as I know, is not being done. Maybe your listeners will know situations, states where it is being done. But as far as I know, that kind of baseline testing doesn't happen anywhere.
And one of the real variables that a lot of listeners may not be familiar with, or we've been told by the industry that they're going miles down into the earth for this, but the depth that they need to do hydraulic fracturing is one of the variables that would have a direct link to possibly contaminating water supplies, right?
Possibly, yes. With fracking into groundwater resources, one of the studies I wrote about last week was by Dom DiGiulio and Rob Jackson, who are both affiliated with Stanford University. And Rob especially is a longtime research scientist who's looked into these issues. And what they found is that there's they looked at Wyoming at publicly available well completion data, and they found that fracking occurs at shallower depths than industry has said in the past. They did caution that, this needs to go through peer review. This was not a study. It was a report. It was a presentation that was given. But I think they feel confident enough to present this to show that, and to have slides at their presentation that plotted where the fracking occurred. And it was not, 2,000, 3,000 feet below the surface, but it was more like, 700 feet. So fracking occurs at a lot of different depths, not just at 2,000 or 3,000 feet below the surface as industry states. And at the shallower depths, that's where there's a greater risk of running into groundwater resources.
Sad eyes, sad eyes. Where you going with that confidence? Sad eyes, sad eyes. Where you going with that confidence? I'm going to where the boats go by. Carried on your river flows so wet. I'm going to where the boats go by. Caledonia River flows so wide, still water laying over, still water laying over, still water laying over. Caledonia River, oh, so.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Neela Banerjee. She's an environmental reporter for the Los Angeles Times. So, Neela, you also have a piece from last week that I wanted to discuss. It's entitled, "Diesel is Used in Fracking Without Permits." Explain why this is newsworthy.
The EPA has no authority over what companies put into the ground as part of fracking. That authority never really existed, and it was weak. And anything that they could have done was weakened further in 2005 with the Energy Policy Act. But the one thing that the EPA can regulate is the use of diesel in underground injection activities, including fracking. And that's because diesel contains some known carcinogens that move quickly through water resources. And so if you're a company and you're going to frack using diesel, and you would use diesel because like some formations absorb water and very easily, and diesel won't be absorbed as easily, then you need to get a Safe Drinking Water Act permit from state regulators. And what these researchers found is that diesel is used in lots of different states where there is a lot of oil and gas activity, a lot of fracking, and they found in these cases about, you know, more than 350 cases that not a single permit application was given to state authorities, and the states themselves didn't issue the permit. So there was, you know, there were, and the permits have greater safeguards in place than if you were a company and you just got a drilling permit from the state. So that is the significance of it. And it was quite a small number out of the 77,000 wells that are listed on Frac Focus. It was only like 350 something. But the difference is that, you know, there's so many loopholes through which companies could set aside what they're actually putting down the hole that the researchers thought that 350 might be conservative, and there might be more there.
And this is in 12 different states. How many states are out of those 77,000 wells are companies fracking? Is it all 50 states at this point, practically?
Oh, no. I mean, there's a lot of places where fracking doesn't occur. It just depends on the geology. I mean, you know, there's, and there are places where the geology might be good for, you know, advantageous for oil and gas development or gas development, and there's no fracking going on yet. I mean, New York is the classic example of, you know, there are some conventional gas wells in New York, but fracking doesn't occur there because there's a bitter fight about whether it should be allowed to happen. Then there's some states, like Wisconsin, for example, where no fracking occurs. They don't have oil and gas reserves, that at least any that have been found yet, that could be fracked. But Wisconsin is affected considerably by the oil and gas boom, because in western Wisconsin, eastern Minnesota, places like that, you have these hills that are getting strip mined because they have sand in them that is used in fracking. So, I think that the oil and gas boom affects a lot of places in a lot of different ways, but it's not just because fracking actually occurs there. It's because there's, you know, there are jobs created, there are factories that are running because they're producing steel pipe, but there's also, you know, hills being strip mined. There are, you know, trains going through your town that contain, you know, volatile hydrocarbons. So, you know, it affects the whole country, even if hydraulic fracturing is not occurring in your county.
So, Neela, you cover both environmental policy, but also energy issues. And so you can hopefully see more of a balance than the layman when it comes to looking at these issues from a clear-eyed perspective. Do you see that the needle has moved in terms of energy independence for the United States? Has the needle moved with all of this fracking activity? Or are you overwhelmed on the environmental side of your work with all of the issues with reportage and transparency and the environmental costs that we've been discussing?
Well, I mean, I think energy independence isn't the best term or the best way to kind of look at this. I don't find that. I think that the way to look at it, because first of all, with natural gas and oil, natural gas and coal, rather, the stuff that we use to power our electricity generation plants and our homes and so on. I mean, that's stuff we've largely gotten domestically, and oil is a global price. Whatever price we pay for oil in the United States is set by global forces. It's not just about how much oil we produce in the U.S.
Is it shifting the paradigm from coal?
Oh, it is. And it's shifting the paradigm in many ways. I mean, I, to be honest, I don't think that the Obama administration could crack down on carbon, could demand a reduction in carbon emissions from power plants if there weren't so much cheap natural gas readily available because of fracking. I think that there's a lot of manufacturing that goes on in this country driven by cheap natural gas. I mean, it's been interesting. There's this fight where the oil and gas companies want to be able to export liquefied natural gas because the price of natural gas is so low. They figure if they find more markets for it, the price will come up a bit. But there are a lot of manufacturers, you know, they're friends in the Chamber of Commerce, right, who don't want natural gas to be exported because they like the fact that it's cheap and they can manufacture domestically. So, you know, there are tangible benefits that increased oil and gas production have brought to our economy the way it is. And our economy is dependent upon hydrocarbons at this point. On the other hand, you know, there are a lot of questions that have emerged that people don't have answers to. I mean, another study that came out in the last few weeks by researchers, I think some of them were from Princeton, but it was a consortium of them, said, you know, that really, like, nobody knows the health impacts of fracking, both, you know, its effects on water supplies, on air, and you know, people living near fracking sites. I mean, so there are a lot of unanswered questions, and I think that's, you know, that's the way I see it, is that you know, there are a lot of questions that still haven't been answered, but to deny the fact that it's boosted the economy and it's made possible, a certain priority of the Obama administration to cut carbon emissions. I mean, I think that would be, you know, that would be unfair and disingenuous too.
I saw a headline that said fracking limited in Pennsylvania due to environmental group. And you think that there's real pullback in Pennsylvania, where I think around 10% of our wells are located. I think they have well over 6,000. But then when you read in, it said they're not signing any new natural gas leases under state parks and forests until at least this fall.
Right.
It's not a huge leap forward for these environmental groups.
The questions that environmentalists have raised, you know, and the science that's come out that the media have helped to disseminate, I think have raised a lot of questions in communities that are affected by rapid oil and gas development. And I think it's the rapidity of the development and the people feeling like they want answers and they want maybe a slower pace of development and they want more local control. I mean, this sort of pushback that you're seeing is has spread across the country, including in places where you would never expect pushback against oil and gas development, places, you know, in Texas and Colorado. You know, there's a lot of complaining in North Dakota about the way things are going there. And, you know, and these are people who, you know, they, unlike environmentalists, they, you know, or some environmentalists, I think some environmentalists just want better regulation of fracking, but they feel like it's going to happen anyway. Others want to ban it outright. But I think, you know, there's a lot of communities that don't want to ban it, but want better regulation, better transparency, better local control. And I think that, you know, that has been, that awareness and that drive have been prompted by the environmental movement and people bringing issues to light. So I don't think it's a finger in the dike, but I think anybody on that side of the issue who wants some kind of slam dunk or some kind of, you know, national ban is going to be waiting a really long time for something like that.
Yeah, I don't mean to diminish the work that environmentalists are doing. In fact, it's more important than ever, and they're making a lot of headway. But I guess what strikes somebody like me when they read this, I wasn't disappointed by the efforts of the environmental groups as much as I was shocked to learn that there actually are natural gas leases signed in state parks and forests. I didn't know that they were allowed to frack in these places. So it seems like a no-brainer. It's like when I think of our state parks and forests, I think of these pristine places, not places where oil and gas exploration is occurring.
No, I mean, you know, that's a valid point. And if people don't want that, you know, then they can vote folks out of office. You know, this is stuff that people's representatives, these are initiatives that people's representatives take on and champion. And I think that there's going to be a long sorting out in communities about what fracking is going to look like and what it's you know, and fracking, I mean, really, that's not a fair term. I mean, what oil and gas development more broadly is going to look like. And you know, we use fracking as shorthand. And I think part of the reason is because this oil and gas development has been brought about by the use of horizontal drilling and high volume hydraulic fracturing. And I think, you know, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a push and pull. And there's going to be efforts by backers of development to enter more places, and there's going to be folks in communities and elsewhere who are going to want to pull back, and at different times, different sides will win. It's going to be, I think it's going to be a long sorting out, and I'm not quite sure there's going to be a uniform application of everything.
She's the energy and environmental policy reporter for the Los Angeles Times, Neela Banerjee. Neela, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome.
And I take to the sky to let you know I'm loving you more to the day I die. Take to the sky to let you know I'm loving you more. If you have anything to do, call me and I will do it for you. And I tell you,
follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. As we referenced filmmaker Josh Fox earlier in the show, it seemed fitting to listen to a bit of my June 26, 2012 interview with Josh. In the climate change quote-unquote debate, the talking point has kind of evolved into, yes, climate change exists, but we just don't know if it's man-made, or we really can't necessarily pinpoint it on inordinate amount of fossil fuels we've been burning over the last century. So let's go through some of the talking points from the industry. They point to an EPA study that says that, quote, the reduction in emissions from increased natural gas use strongly outweighs the detrimental effects of increased methane emissions. First, is that true? And is your biggest fear water contamination, or is that just incorrect?
What the gas industry is actually doing is countering a scientific report that came out of Cornell, a peer-reviewed scientific report that was also backed up by NOAA, that showed that fracking actually vents off enormous amounts of methane into the atmosphere. They have a huge leakage rate, not only under the ground, but above ground. So their pipes leak. I mean, gas is a gas. It's not easy to contain. It's lighter than air. It leaks through seals. It leaks out of compressor stations. It leaks out of pipelines. It leaks, and it is vented off on the wells themselves for the first several weeks, or several days to several weeks, while the wells are being completed.
Yeah, just try keeping a child's balloon inflated for a few weeks.
Exactly. You know, on things, gases under pressure like to squirm out. But that's obvious. What that means, though, is that methane is many, many times more potent than carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere as a greenhouse gas. So it's that much greater of a problem for global climate change and global warming. So when you actually vented off huge amounts of methane, it displaces the benefit that you might get from burning gas over burning coal. And the gas industry loves, so it's been shown that frack gas and coal generation are on a par in terms of how bad they are for the atmosphere. Now, the gas industry loves to compete against coal because everybody hates coal. And coal is very, very nasty and polluting in all aspects, both burning and mining and mountaintop removal. And certainly we're not advocating coal. But the gas industry loves to pit itself against coal and say, look, we're better than coal. We're cleaner burning than coal. Well, as it turns out, in terms of emissions for climate change, that's not true. It's also, I would say, questionable that it's in those areas. It creates ground-level ozone. It creates hazardous air pollutants. In the drilling areas themselves. So you're just moving a pollution source from where you're burning coal, for example, in a power plant, to where you're drilling for gas in the field, and you're not getting any appreciable benefit in terms of climate change. But
so it's almost like the tobacco industry saying, well, we have these filtered cigarettes that are better than the unfiltered cigarette.
Yeah, exactly. And that's I think, a pretty good analogy. The main issue here, though, is that you're asking the wrong question when you're comparing gas to coal. If the question is, what's better than coal, and then want to come back and the answer is gas, well, first of all, it's not true. But it's also the wrong question. The better question is, what's better than fossil fuels? What's the alternative to fossil fuels? And we have alternatives to fossil fuels. We have wind, we have solar, we have geothermal, we have tidal power, we have hydroelectric. All of these things combined. And this was shown in a front page article on Scientific American by Stanford professor Mark Jacobson and many, many other people backing him up. But this is a great one for listeners to go and find because it's so easy. Just put in Mark Jacobson, Plan for Renewable Energy, Scientific American, and you'll read it, that forecasts how we can move away from fossil fuels, generate all the power we need out of renewable energy in a very short time period. I think it's by 2030. So within our lifetimes, Mark Jacobson has laid that out because as it turns out, you know, the sun shines during the day, but the wind blows harder at night. So you can set this situation up where you're actually, when the sun goes down, you're switching over to the wind power and you're allowing your grid to be powered on the wind and the sun. And it's brilliant and it's very simple. Most really super world-changing, brilliant things are quite simple. And this is one thing that is astoundingly simple. It's like, well, the wind blows harder at night and the sun shines better during the day. Let's power things that way. And we know that we can power everything that we need from that, from electricity generation to home heating to transportation, if we're talking about changing over to electric cars. Tesla and the Nissan Leaf and these other cars that are electric cars that are coming out, they're really, really advancing in technology, and they're becoming more and more affordable and more available over the next 5-10 years.
To hear this interview from June 26, 2012 in its entirety, go to seachangeradio.com and type in search term Josh Fox.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Clarence Gatemouth Brown, Daniel Lenoir, and Bloodstone. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.